Hello, and welcome to Season 3, Episode 27 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Drs. Justin Winzenberg and Stephen Jones. In this podcast, we look to explore truth, beauty, wisdom, and goodness at the intersection of faith and scholarship. In today's episode, Justin and I talk about finding cultural differences and exploring their impact in global Christian reasoning. But first, here are the highlights, lowlights, and insights.
I tell you what, it's good to see you. It seems like it's been way too long here since we've actually caught up.
It's been a few months anyway. It's gone so fast. The end of summer and the beginning of fall for, I think, both of us has just been so intense.
Yeah, that's going to make, you know, our highlights, lowlights, and insights interesting because, you know, at least since we've recorded last, we've had a lot that's happened. So,
Wait, 4 months. It's been 4 months.
Yeah, I think that seems right to me. It seems like it was probably around the summertime
that we maybe last caught up.
So, how then would you sum up a highlight? I mean, I guess this could be recent. This could be since we've recorded.
Oh man.
What's a recent highlight for you?
Yeah. I think one highlight has been that we've come to the end of our first, full program year. So we've been here over 2 years, I don't know, coming up on 2.5, but we finished at the end of the summer, our first full program year. And I think it was really exciting to see kind of all these things that we had hoped for, because we had done a lot of planning with our partners that are on staff here before we came, and kind of imagined like what it could it be. And of course, there's so much that before you get here, you couldn't even imagine, like, you know, like the office I'm sitting in, for example. Like I had no idea what to even imagine that would be like. But actually, a lot of the things that we had set out to accomplish, we've done, and that is really exciting. I think kind of looking back and seeing different things take shape, whether that's working with interns and residents or working with, you know, getting our library up and going, or, you know, trying to work with short-term teams and help people think through things. I think I even like keeping the podcast going, you know, there's just been all these different things that we've been kind of, how will this play out? How will this work? And, you know, everything of course looks slightly different than we imagined it, but like seeing it actually happen has been exciting. We did a retrospective not long ago and looked back and was like, wow, actually a lot has been accomplished. So
nice. Yeah. What's the details on this library you're talking about?
Oh, just, it's the one I'm sitting in. We've got probably 1500 books and it's being pretty actively used. We brought over, I don't know, 800 or 900 of them on a pallet when we moved here. And then it keeps growing because we love books. And so. And then, I mean, we're still trying to figure out things like, you know, how do digital resources work and all that, but it's been fun. I think even seeing the books kind of regularly getting checked out and checked back in and seeing people using them, that's been really fun for me.
I wish it was easy to get books over to you because I'd just been clearing off my shelves and I buy books at a rate, unfortunately, that is quicker than I can read them. Uh-huh. But so I'm like, it's time to clear off some of these old books in my office that I'm not really reading or won't read. And so I've been putting them out kind of right outside my office for students to come and pick through. And a lot of times they get picked up, but I mean, I have a pretty good chunk of books that I probably could get to y'all, but I don't know how that'd be easy to, that'd be easy to ship to you without it costing more than what these books are worth.
Right. So what's a highlight for you, Ben?
Yeah. So one highlight for me recently is that family and I had a chance to visit a church in our neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And it's an ACNA Anglican church. And I really appreciated its liturgy. I found it to be really fascinating, especially from area in comparison to a lot of the church contexts that I'm used to. In a lot of ways, it's caused me to feel like, I don't know what the word is, some of the Protestant and particularly evangelical liturgies are wanting in a lot of ways. And because I've really appreciated the richness of the Anglican liturgy that they use. And so including some things from the Book of Common Prayer. I mean, the Book of Common Prayer includes the liturgy in there as well. But it's just, it's been really enriching. So it's been encouraging. Yeah.
So just this last week we were at an Anglican service and.
Oh, you were?
Yeah. Yeah. So we go every now and then, over by Alexanderplatz, there's, Marienkirche, which is this old church, and the church itself is not Anglican, but there's an Anglican church from the west side of town that meets there Sunday evenings. And we go sometimes, and I really resonate with what you're saying about the liturgy. In fact, you know, there's obviously just as has been the case the whole time we've been doing this podcast, there's so many hard things going on in the world. Yeah. And I really found a lot of comfort in the liturgy. And even the way that there was the time of prayer of intercession, and there was somebody who had put together, you know, their prayer of intercession. It was so easy for us to join in with that, you know, just with the scripted responses, but it felt really meaningful for me. So it's not like our church home, but it's something that when we've been there, it's been a really encouraging space for us.
Yeah, it felt the same way. One of the first times that we visited, they had that prayer time that you're talking about as well, which is common in the Anglican liturgy, I think. And you know, I was kind of taught, or maybe implicitly taught when I started attending evangelical churches, that like written prayers are like lame and meaningless. And yet the richness of the written prayers that were being spoken, right, I found way more profound than the willy-nilly just pray whatever comes to your head thing that often happens in evangelical settings. And I to be honest, I found it way, way more satisfying. I mean, they had some really intentional prayers. So they have ones where they're praying for some of the conflicts that are happening in the world. They have ones where they're praying for a recognition of our stewardship of the earth and of creation. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I've never heard these prayers spoken.
No, I mean, you've been pushing for that actually. At district conference and other places and.
There's so much richness to it. Then they do have prayers for specific people as well. Like, and I actually, when I got the Book of Common Prayer, they have some really profound prayers, and they have just a boatload of them kind of listed on occasional prayers. Some for leaders, political leaders, which I found so fascinating, because it's like the fill in the blank that they have is for the current leader. It doesn't matter what partisan party they are. And they're praying that the leader would rule with justice and rule with wisdom. And I'm like, man, that's a great prayer. Like,
yeah, right.
Yeah. But I'm like, it would be almost unthinkable, I think, for some Christians to think of praying a prayer like that, because they're so offended by the leader at the moment. And maybe even at times, right, for good reason. But I thought, why not pray that they would rule with wisdom and rule with justice? Right. And I mean, I don't know. I thought it was rule. Maybe it's not the right word. It sounds very, you know, monarchy. but anyhow, I mean, there's so other things about the liturgy that I've really appreciated. There's a definite prayer of confession every single week. There's Eucharist or communion every single week. There's the intercessory prayer moments every single week. There's multiple scriptures read throughout the duration of the service on a very specific time frame to work through the scriptures.
Yeah.
Also, I find that there's singing responses, which I love, because what they aren't a full song,
right?
Like three verses and a couple stanzas and choruses and all that. It's one line. And then it's like a responsive song, one stanza essentially. Yeah. And I thought that's a really interesting way to do it. And there's some repetition. You always read through a gospel. There's a few other things I think that I've really appreciated, the Nicene Creed. So you just remind yourselves of sort of the basics of the faith,
which seems
that's universal in a lot of ways, seems, you know, like really across the world
doing, because it feels like a lot of times we kind of get caught up in the, I don't know, we call it what, popcorn prayers or whatever, but like the thing that's on the top of your mind. But I feel like it can get easy to kind of, lose the plot of what even is the faith, and you kind of get caught up in the theme of the moment or whatever. And I think sometimes having those liturgy that brings you back to why are we even gathered together is really rich. That's definitely something that we felt a couple of times leaving this other service, was just like, okay, like reaffirming core commitments of faith is really rich. It would be super interesting to take somebody who like grew up in that church and take them to a church that you've been most of your adult life in, see if they had a similar experience. Like, is it the, I don't know, like there's this, I'm thinking almost like there are these different holes in our liturgies. And if you mix them together, is that, you know, like, is there a specific scratch or a specific itch that you get that service style scratches?
It's funny you bring that up, because I was talking to my grandpa just about our experience in this service, and he's, you know, Roman Catholic and has been Roman Catholic his whole life. And he said something along the lines, I wish I remembered exactly what he said to me, but he said something like, well, this must be way more, how do you say, like, he was comparing it to other churches I've been going to in the past that he's visited with me, you know, evangelical churches.
Right, right.
And he said something along the lines of, oh, this must, you know, must be nice to not be, you know, always experiencing that. I don't know how he put it, if it was like a willy nilly or just a shallow church like you've been, like, so you've gone to in the past. I don't know if shallow is the right word, but you know, that was like kind of the sentiment of these churches that don't have a liturgy and they're just kind of do whatever they want to off the top of their head. Mm. You know, it almost has no, he felt like it had no rhyme or reason.
Sure.
Clearly it does have rhyme and reason. Clearly there is a liturgy, but it's just not the same kind of liturgy. Yeah. So anyhow, I thought that was fascinating. So to answer your, maybe a little bit of what you're asking, right, is maybe somebody who's been in those spaces for a long time could potentially go to these evangelical settings and feel like, what are they doing here?
Yeah. On the other hand, they could feel like, I mean, if they're ready for that, it could feel like, oh, there's some freedom here, you know? And
oh, absolutely. You know? Yeah. And I think, you know, there's so many folks in the 80s, I think, who came out of, you know, like a more nominal Catholic background.
Yeah, yeah.
And into evangelicalism, and they found it to be the most freeing and spirit led thing that they had ever experienced. So I don't want to, you know, downplay that experience for some people, but it's funny. I get a feeling like maybe it's been 20 some years now since like those people were kind of the main leaders in evangelical movements. And I feel like now maybe the new generation of people are getting
restless,
dissatisfied. Yeah. You said restless, I say dissatisfied with just some of the ways we've done things. I've definitely felt that, but that's a long highlight there. But so maybe I don't know. I don't know if I need an insight, because that's kind of a lot of insight to be honest. So
yeah.
So we could maybe reiterate that as our insight.
Yeah, that sounds good.
But it does reflect a lot on church traditions and things that hold meaning. Well, what's been a low light for you?
I think so. It's been interesting this week. I'll go really narrow. We've been kind of on vacation. I guess Jenny has been. I've been on a mix of, we have these focus days. And so I've been on a mix of vacation and focus days this week because our kids are on fall break. And so we're trying to be present with them. And what's been really interesting is how unrefreshing it has been. I think part of what
I've been there. Someone will ask you, oh, was that vacation restful?
And you're like, leave me alone. Don't ask me that question.
Yeah, like not even close. In some ways, taking that vacation or time off makes things worse, right? Because sometimes you feel like you should be resting.
Right, yeah.
Which means then you're like not getting as much done as you probably need to. Uh-huh. But yeah.
Yeah. I had really hoped to travel somewhere. And I think for a couple of reasons, it didn't make sense for us to go anywhere. But I think there's this part of what I'm realizing is we're in a stage where it's like we're in kind of the second layer of adjustment to living here, where now we've been through, I think, a lot of the really hard parts of culture shock, but now we're into some of the stuff of like really getting integrated into the systems of living here while we're also still connected to systems of living in the States. And I think that's really been challenging. For example, this week I got a couple of letters from the Finanzamt, which is the financial office of Germany through our district. Anyway, so that like when you file taxes, you get notes from them.
Sure.
And we have another thing that we're trying to resolve with the Jugendamt, which is the youth office. And all this has to do with money stuff and trying to figure out how much should we pay for certain things and how much does the state pay and what do we owe and like all the paperwork stuff. And it's just exhausting. I think it's partly exhausting because we're doing a lot of it for the first time. And then like, our service providers that were like the guy that prepares taxes for us. It's our first time really working with him. And there's, you know, and then at the same time we still have to file taxes in the US. And so there's just all of these layers of complexity that are like, okay, like if we're really here, this is absolutely part of living here. But at the same time, we're also still US people. And last week we were getting the kids' passports renewed, right? Like there's just all of these different things. But I think the maybe the specific low light is like realizing actually I felt pretty stressed over the last few months. And I think less of that stress comes from my work than I would have thought. Like being away from work is not creating this space where I feel, oh, I'm really relaxed. And like, thank goodness I have a break from that. Like actually like being in the office recording with you today, I'm like, and part of that's just connecting with you, but part of that's also just this is like, I actually feel pretty confident and comfortable doing some of this, like being in this space. And even though, I mean, we have all these different things we're trying to problem solve and figure out, that's pretty rewarding. But a lot of the like daily life stuff down to whether that's, I mean, we're trying to figure out family budget and managing in some ways budgets on both sides of the ocean, and trying to figure out things related to, I guess there's the fundraising side, which is technically part of the job. It also feels like this other thing. And I don't know. Yeah. Just I think we're in kind of an extended period of time where it's going to be like, it's going to take a while before it's not exhausting to just kind of live. If that makes sense.
Yeah. I think it's interesting how you put it, like how you're not really stressed out at work or about work, but right. that other stuff that's going on is stressing you out. I feel like I can kind of understand what you're saying. I don't know. We got a lot going on at work at the moment, and I've got stuff piling up and there's some stress to that, but sometimes it's actually the stuff I don't get done at home that like just piles up the stress for me. Cause then when I get home, I feel like, geez, there's just so much to do and there's so little time to do it.
Yeah.
I feel that way at work some too, but yeah. And then for you, that must be escalated even more with just some of those logistical things of living cross-culturally too, that you have to deal with and address, like when it comes to passports and all that. So I can totally see how that would be not restful and how work might be rest.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I have a new scale for measuring my mental and emotional well-being, and it's the pile on my chair.
Like what do you mean, like paperwork and stuff?
Well, in this case it's clothes, but yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
When we're doing well, there's no pile. And then we went through probably a 4-month window of time where there was always a pile, and I was like, oh, I don't like living like this, but,
that totally makes sense. Wow. Huh.
What's a low light for you, Ben?
I feel like both at work and outside of work, I've heard so many people, colleagues and friends, who are either going through really incredibly difficult things with family and family members' health and being completely overwhelmed about how much work is stacking up for them at work. And it just seems like there's a heaviness right now. I don't hear almost anybody that I know, friends or colleagues, who feel like, yeah, man, things are going great right now. Like, you know, every now and then you'll hear some excitement and energy, especially at the beginning and ends of semesters when it comes to the academic year.
Right.
But even outside of work right now, I'm not hearing that from anybody, like nobody. I'm not hearing any sense of like excitement or positivity. There's a lot of like, oh man, people being overwhelmed. And you know, like the weather hasn't even hit here yet in Minnesota. And that's really going to mess with people when it happens. Cause that brings a certain other cloud with it.
We've got at it times. the darkness is
Oh yeah. We'll have daylight savings this weekend, which will make it, you know, dark around 5 o'clock at night. And that's going to change the demeanor as well.
Yeah.
But yes, it's a hard thing to articulate. So there's a sort of low light of just doesn't seem like anybody's doing all that great right now.
I can resonate with that. That's really, I feel like, and I don't know if it's how much of it is the conflicts that are going on.
Yeah.
Obviously, Ukraine and, Israel, Gaza, and then of course there are others, but those two are especially big on people's minds. There's plenty of bad news. Even for us, like there's just this drag of like our investments. Like, so when we sold our house, we put some money aside. In case we need to put a down payment on an apartment or something, you know, when we're back in the States. And like all of our investments have shrunk so much over the last 2 years. And,
That's, you know, it's discouraging.
Like, so just things like that just put this pressure on. It's like, we don't, you know, I mean, it's invested. It's not something we need at the moment, and hopefully it'll come back by the time we need it. But I think there's just in so many different areas, just pressure. I don't know.
Yeah. Maybe the good news is for any of our listeners out there that are feeling that it's like, hey, look at, you're in the same boat here. We're all in the same boat. Right. Like, we know what you're going through.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we'll make it through it, but man, things just seem to be a bit of a downer right now for a lot of people. And I'm not feeling like particularly down myself, but I do feel like that kind of just sense of like, not necessarily energy or energized at the moment. And certainly not always like excited, but just like trying to get by almost as a feeling.
Yeah.
Trying to keep your head above water. Yeah. It's kind of like that.
And we've noticed it too, even with people keeping up with us from the States. Like we've had a pretty major drop off from a bunch of people that, like, I would say on average, we're hearing less from people, and it seems to be because of the, just the intensity that they're feeling in life.
Yeah. That's it's a hard thing to articulate, but I definitely notice it. There's no doubt about it.
Super interesting. Huh. We'll be back in a moment with our discussion about cultural difference in global Christian reasoning. Our show is supported by patrons who, among other things, make it possible to record remotely. Reed Peters is a recognized patron of the show, and you can be too. Find our Patreon channel in our show notes.
Yeah, I'd love to talk with you some more here then about your thesis project. And I think last that we left off, our most recent episode was covering some of your literature review and your
methods. Some of the methodology. Yeah,
methodology is last one that we talked about. But now we're moving into an really fascinating section of your dissertation, especially something, you know, I'm interested in. And it's a chapter that you call Analysis of Culture Within Global Christian Reasoning. Do you want to bring our listeners up to speed as to what are you trying to accomplish here, and what is this global Christian reasoning that you're talking about?
Yeah. So this chapter in some ways is an odd duck in the dissertation because the dissertation is about cultural differences in international relations, right? So international politics, and
it's not a theology or a church history sort of dissertation,
right? Not at all. And at the same time, what I was trying to do, and we talked about this some in the methods section, but I was looking for a way to say, okay, the way that culture is defined within political science, I'm very dissatisfied with, and I want to try to bring in a different way of looking at it. But in order to bring it in, I need to find it somewhere. And so I remember one day I was driving to work and I was like, how do I move forward on this dissertation? I knew roughly what I wanted to do. And this was still at the stage where I was picking between three or four main different directions. And I just had this moment where I felt like the idea just, I don't know, came to me or materialized in my head.
And you said you're in the car, right?
Yeah, I was in the car. Yeah.
Some of the best thinking I've ever done is in my car.
this maybe explains serious. Some of my problems. Like, I finally last week drove for the first time since we've been here.
Oh, you did?
I did. Yeah.
But you know, this could occur on the bike as well, right? So
it could, but I live so close to, we just walk everywhere. So anyway, I had this realization that, okay, I know that there's a literature that no is too strong. I have a feeling, that there's this literature that shows cultural difference making a difference, being important.
Because if I'm understanding you correctly, right, that maybe just to remind our listener, you said you were dissatisfied with the kind of state of affairs and international relations, and that this could somehow be a way forward, right? Once you're able to basically grasp how culture impacts a group in their way that they think in an analyze like a text.
Right. And specifically an epistemic community, right? So people who are functioning in roughly the same area of thought using roughly similar tools, because this is part of the pushback I was getting on the political science side, is saying, well, hey, this is an epistemic community. We all are in the same area and we're using roughly the same tools. And so culture doesn't really matter. And I was like, I don't think that's right.
Yeah.
But I needed to be able to show that somehow if I was going to be able to bring the idea of culture the way I was talking about it, which is, again, moving away from the civilizational discourse, moving away from these kind of really reified versions of culture to a much more processual version of culture that is dealing with these different frameworks and interpretation and these kinds of questions. And so I had come across enough things in what I ended up calling global Christian reasoning, which doesn't really exist, but
you made the term up.
I made the term up, but the idea of, you know, that there are people writing around the world from different cultural perspectives about Christian thought and reasoning. And I focused it primarily within the Protestant side of things. Mm. And then especially looking at versions of Christianity that had kind of emerged in the last 100 years or so, or expressions, I should say, of Christianity that emerged in the last 100 years or so, kind of out of this large mission movement that had happened over the last couple centuries. And so it meant there's a literature where a lot of it is in English because it's one of the dominant languages of that discourse. And so it was very accessible. And at the same time, there were people articulating their understanding of Christianity, both, I mean, really at multiple levels, epistemologically, even cosmologically, theologically, and then also practically, like it down to questions of pastoral care and discipleship, that in all of these different ways, people are doing this reasoning. And that's why I didn't call it global Christian theology, because it also included this practical side. And as they're doing that, they're sometimes really engaging these ideas of culture. But I hadn't ever actually stopped and studied that. It was just an impression I had. And so the question was, could I take these ideas, these cultural frameworks that I had identified in the methods section, go into global Christian reasoning and find them? Mm. And then if I could find them, could I find that they were making a difference? And so there were two different steps of this chapter. The first was looking to, can I find these things present in that literature? And then the second was, does it matter that it's there?
Yes. So a lot of ways what you're doing right is that you're trying to discern the impact that culture is having on this epistemic community that you call global Christian reasoning, in order to try to demonstrate how some differences in culture could be impacting, right, their views on things, even though they have shared sort of, I don't want to say values, but a shared
text and shared tools. There you
go, shared text, yep. Yeah. Yeah, that's so fascinating. Did you get any, this isn't something that just came to my head, I'm sure we've maybe talked about this before, but did you get any pushback at all about calling global Christian reasoning an epistemic community? Like, could there be problems with, like, I don't know what the word would be, like an oversimplification of the idea of Christians across the globe sharing a certain thing? Like you said, shared text and shared
tools.
So yeah. I guess that works within Protestantism fairly well, because the shared text is a little bit more unified than if you look beyond Protestantism, right? Because then you have, you've got what, communities in Egypt, you get, you know, Eastern Orthodox and Roman Catholics whose text isn't identical, right, to Protestant text. So that's probably helpful. So how much of that was on your radar when you were thinking about identifying global Christian reasoning as a sort of epistemic community? Did you have to be like, well, okay, if I'm too broad, then this thing could collapse because the sharedness is maybe not there enough?
I think I didn't have to worry so much about that, because the first concern was just, if it was too broad, then I would never be able to isolate enough to actually research. And so my focus started relatively narrow, and the goal was only to provide an exemplary look at those things, not a comprehensive look. It was just saying, I find it? And so even a fair number of the people were interacting with each other's texts or interacting with similar texts, and which is part of the sign of an epistemic community, right? If they're referencing similar journal articles or similar books or things like that. And not that they all were, but there's some coherence within the group that I was looking at.
So to put it even more simply, in some ways, like if you're thinking of the shared text as a biblical text for global Christian reasoning, you could say there are Christians all over the world who are, say, reading the Gospels. And then you could, and then you're thinking, to what extent might these various cultural frameworks be able to explain or demonstrate some of the differences and how this shared text is understood?
Right.
Because what you're essentially hoping, this is a big setup chapter, right? Setup chapter.
So this chapter, if this chapter was unsuccessful at finding cultural difference, or unsuccessful at saying, yes, it matters, then the dissertation stops.
Yeah.
Which in some ways would have been nice, right? Like, 'cause then I could be done writing. But yeah, this chapter was kind of a pivotal chapter. If I couldn't find culture in these other places, or I couldn't find it making a difference, then there would be nothing else to say.
Yeah. So it was in some ways too, it seems, please correct me if you think my articulation's wrong here. It seems like you took a pretty big swing here because of the field that you're in and then using this as an example, not because I'm suggesting some like entirely like anti-Christian sentiments coming from your institution. I'm not thinking along those lines, but just thinking of how unusual this kind of focus must be within an international relations PhD.
Yeah. I mean,
or so am I wrong?
Well, there's a book and I am looking to where it is on the bookshelf, but I can't quite read it because it's so I can't think of what it's called, but there's this whole argument that international relations in general has underspecified religion as an important topic.
Oh, that totally makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. But if that's true, then it would be true. This is a bit unusual because religious stuff isn't usually brought into the conversation with international relations necessarily, right?
When it is, it's usually looked at more through the lens of identity or power structures or those kinds of things. And in some ways, I'm not trying to make a political science argument through this chapter. All I'm trying to say is, does culture exist, right? And of course, exist is maybe even too strong of a word, but are these ideas of cultural differences, can they be found out in the wild, right? That's it's almost like this is the field research of saying, okay, I found this thing and then the next question in the following chapter is, well, then if that actually exists out there, when we bring it inside into political science, should we expect that it could make a difference? And that's all the stronger that the dissertation is. It's not it doesn't say here's how it does. It just says, it seems possible, right? I think I talked before about the hoop test, that it's a pretty low bar that I was trying to get over with the dissertation overall. But in order to even approach that bar, I had to first say, yes, here's the thing that I'm looking for.
So how much of this chapter, you know, I don't remember the time frame here well, so you have to remind me, how much of this chapter may have been impacted by some of the conversations that we were having? Not, I'm not asking whether I affected you. I'm wondering, like, we were co-teaching a class on global theology and contextualization.
Yeah.
Like, did any of that, you feel like, and that those things help you ruminate on this, or was this, occur apart from that? I can't remember.
A lot of, what you had brought to that class was what made me think, I think there is something there, because it wasn't my field, right? Like, biblical studies is not my field. And so I think that's what gave me enough of a sense of, I think I can go looking for it. And then let's see. So I would have been writing this in the spring of 2021, I think is when I was really fall of 2020, spring of 2021. Is when I was really into this chapter. And so we had already taught a couple of times, but class I had that sense that I think I can find this stuff. I think it exists out there, but it wasn't from me being like, oh yeah, I have all of the literature. I definitely had to go looking for it. and then I did have a little while where I was like, man, I don't know if I'm going to be able to find anything, which I think is a pretty common experience in dissertation writing.
Well, and to be fair, in this particular subject or global Christian reasoning, it's a big ask because there are literature out there that will self-reflect on some of these cultural frameworks more explicitly than others. And the places that don't do it explicitly, then you're having to look for it in wide ranges of texts that may or may not have it.
Well, and
that's where it becomes really difficult.
And I got really worried about it. Cause I was like, oh, that could be a whole dissertation in and of itself.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
But one of the things I found was, so a lot of, I don't know what the appropriate ways to say this now are, but a lot of the kind of white Western theologizing and pastoral reflections and those kinds of things tend to be rather culturally not self-aware. Mm-hmm. So they don't necessarily identify and say, as a, North American white Christian, this is how I'm seeing this. But a lot of other texts do self-identify and often in contrast with that group.
Yeah.
And so some of that's coming from post-colonial movements and some of that's coming from, and which I didn't actually get into the post-colonial literature directly, but there's kind of there's kind of this feel of, okay, as we're trying to theologize now in response to what was theologized for us in kind of early ethnocentric missional, early is not the right word, but earlier ethnocentric missional theologizing that happened. Now we're doing that. We're doing our own local theologizing in response to the recognition that what was given to us from the West was in fact cultural. It wasn't neutral, which is the way a lot of times was presented. And so you do end up in the literature with this kind of interesting, you know, other voices from around the world saying, okay, as a person from this background or our people group from this set of cultural backgrounds is seeing the world this way. And we see that in contrast to the kind of even sometimes almost hegemonic theological approaches coming out of the West. And so you see some identification happening there.
Yeah. This is so fascinating. And I'm encouraged that some of what we were doing in our classroom, you know, might have sparked some thoughts for you. I'm sure I wasn't very helpful. I'm not an expert at all in global Christian theology, but I'm a sympathizer, as you know, and incredibly like a big time learner in terms of, I love learning more about it. And I think what you have here, a lot of the stuff that you look at isn't stuff I necessarily would have known about myself. Mm-hmm. I probably wasn't any help to you on these, but I'm encouraged that like, I think what I'm seeing in this chapter, it made me think of our class because I thought, wow, this is the kind of stuff that like, if we were able to continue to teach that class together, we could have like honed in on even more specifically.
Right.
And so let's talk a little bit about what kind of stuff you have in this chapter. So you got the general framework of global Christian reasoning, but then you go into these sort of sub frameworks, which look to me like how would you describe what are these frameworks you look at? Are they cultural frameworks?
Yeah. So in the method section, I had identified four cultural frameworks and then had operationalized them.
That's right.
This is what the frameworks are, and this is what I mean by them. So the first was shame, honor, guilt, innocence, which includes as part of that the idea of face work versus standards was part of one of the ways that I operationalized that, as well as external judgment versus internal judgment. And so then what I was doing is looking for those. Another was negative view of confession versus positive view of confession, and then collective implications versus individual implications. And so I was looking in global Christian reasoning saying, can I find those things? And I found all of those things there. The second was time orientation. That section was really interesting, but I had past, present, imagine. Future, and synchronous versus sequence. And then I think time versus event were the ways that was laid out. And then there was the third framework was authority. And I was looking at consent and involvement versus authority centered versus authoritarian, and then ascribe versus achieve authority, and then high power distance and low power distance. The fourth was human nature and looking at good versus good and evil neutral versus good and evil mixed versus evil were the four ways that was laid out. And then I also, as I went, I was paying attention to, are there other frameworks here? And originally I had this whole other set of potential frameworks that I could look for, of inductive frameworks that I could find while I was actually doing the reading. And I didn't need them because I found evidence for everything that I was looking for, but I did find that this idea of land came out as being really important. It was something that, and also the intersection between land, time, and suffering was really important. And so I won't go into that now because that's this whole kind of other area that's to the side. But what I did basically is I looked to say, are people talking about global Christian reasoning? Are they engaging global Christian reasoning, saying that these frameworks matter or demonstrating that these frameworks matter? And what was great is because some of these non-Western authors were trying to say, hey, we're coming to different conclusions as we read the text, and we think it's because of these cultural reasons, it actually made it really explicit. I thought I was going to have to do all this coding, like an iterative axial coding process to find this stuff in the literature. And in fact, it was all spelled out. So I didn't even have to do the coding. I just found it. Like I found other authors saying these things directly. And so that made it really, I felt very confident that in terms of saying, okay, is there an epistemic community that's saying cultural differences matter? Like I don't even have to bring my own interpretation to it. They are literally saying it matters.
Hmm. Yeah. And tell us a little bit about how you end this chapter. This looks very interesting in terms of how, what you do with those frameworks and the shared textual idea.
Yeah. And so this is where the idea of speech act theory became really important practically for me of saying, okay, so we have for the most part agreement on the locution, which is, you know, what are the specific words that are being said? Now, of course, there are layers of that, right? Because there's the, what does it mean in the original language? Right.
Yeah. And then there's, especially when, because each of these epistemic, each of these communities, which are, is a part of a shared epistemic community of global Christian reasoning, are probably reading texts in their own language, right? So translationally, and you, I think you even note this, there could be extreme differences, right? Like in terms of that.
There can be. Yeah. And people are interacting with, for the most part, the underlying text, there's an agreement on the locution. There's one difference where somebody noted that they were looking at a difference between whether something was considered to be part of the original text or not.
Sure.
But for the rest of it, everybody was saying the underlying text, we agree on the locution. Now the translated text, of course, you're getting into interpretation as soon as you have translation.
Well, and to be fair, I think, you know, this is pretty easily evident in some ways if you're in a cross-cultural environment that isn't your own, you know, native culture, and you're hearing like a biblical text being talked about, even if it's being translated to you, what's being said by the person in their native language, like a lot, these texts are noticeable and identifiable. You're not like, what? That's nothing like Romans, you know, like you can kind of tell like, oh yeah, that's Romans 5.
Or, I mean, actually I love to, one of the things I like to do when I'm in a service now is if somebody reads a text, I'll also look it up. And depending on what language it's being read in, I'll look it up in English, German, and Spanish. And it's really interesting to see how those pull out different elements of the underlying ideas. And I don't have access personally to the underlying languages, to the Hebrew, Aramaic, or Greek, right? Like I don't have that, but I love seeing, but yeah, you're right. There's definitely a sense of, even though they are bringing out different shades of meaning, you can tell usually, I mean, sometimes even somebody will read a text in a language I don't know. And just from the flow of it, I'm like, oh, I think that sounds like this text. Mm-hmm. And sure enough that it often is. So, but what I did is I looked for framework one, which was the shame, honor, guilt, innocence, I looked at Romans 1:23, 2:23, and 3:23 and tried to say, okay, how does, for example, how is this being interpreted from an Asian perspective, with a particular, and when I say Asian, I mean a self-identified Asian perspective. Mm-hmm. And then how does that contrast with a non-Asian perspective, where those people who are bringing those perspectives are also engaging questions of, for example, shame and honor, guilt and innocence. Yeah, same kind of thing then in time orientation. That was in Ecclesiastes 3:1-8. And I picked these passages just based on the idea of like, I think maybe this passage will give me access, right? So I'm not going through looking through all of scripture trying to say, does this exist or not? I'm like, okay, what's a passage that I think would be likely for a difference to show up if that difference exists? So I'm like, Ecclesiastes seemed like a place where time difference might matter. You know, cause there's a time for everything and a season for every activity under the heavens. I'm like, okay, well, if there's a difference in time, you know, and this is where we have that time for war, time for peace, and so on. If that exists, if the cultural difference that I'm thinking of exists, this seems like a place I might find it.
What's so fascinating about this is you could write a dissertation on each of these by themselves. Like you could have a whole dissertation that looks at like shame, honor, guilt, and innocence, and then surveys like biblical passages where that might occur and see how it's interpreted differently across cultures. Like that would be such, I mean, that those could be like individual published volumes in and of themselves, right? Like part of a bigger series of like, all right, this whole book is on different interpretations of passages related to time orientation, like across, you know, global Christian theology and biblical interpretation. Like that'd be so fascinating.
Yeah, for sure. I think, and that's also where, and I mentioned before, there's always this hesitation, right? In my own research, I'm like, I'm not a biblical scholar. I'm not a trained biblical. I mean, I studied it in my undergrad, right? But I don't have any graduate level training in biblical analysis or textual analysis or that kind of thing, biblical textual analysis or, you know, and so like, I could also imagine somebody doing that project and maybe saying, I don't know if, you know, maybe Jones was out to lunch on this, you know, but that's part of the beauty of scholarship is you get to have that conversation.
And this is where it's a benefit that you're not a biblical, you know, studies scholar in particular, you're an interculturalist, right? Or like,
right.
You're working from within the frame of cultural differences and looking at through cultural lenses. And that gives you a sort of eye to some of the ways people have interpreted these things in ways that maybe biblical studies scholars at times, certainly white and Western biblical studies scholars aren't always aware of. And so like there's a benefit, I think, to that approach, even though like you're self-admittedly not necessarily trained, particularly like in that field, like within PhD studies or anything.
Right. Yeah. And that's also why I asked somebody to be on my committee who was also on your committee to, you know, to kind of, at least if I was totally out to lunch that he would catch it. So,
Yeah. And I mean, and what's interesting about, you know, my PhD advisor being on your committee is his own experiences cross-culturally as well.
Right. Yep.
As a native German who lived and taught in the UK for quite a while and then had lived in the US for extended periods of time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, having some of those things on his own radar probably helped.
Yeah, for sure. So then, framework three, authority in Exodus. So this is looking at the Ten Commandments, which again, I'm like, well, maybe I would find authority there. Right. And then human nature in Romans 5:12.
Yeah. Fascinating.
And so, which of course Augustine had some thoughts on, and do you say Augustine or Augustine?
I say Augustine, but you know, there are some friends and I've been debating this lately.
That's funny.
Okay. Yeah. So what do you end up concluding then in this chapter?
So I ended up concluding that yes, cultural differences can meaningfully affect the ability of actors from different cultures to arrive at shared meanings of shared text and events. And I confirmed hypothesis one, which is the first time that I'm actually engaging the hypotheses, right, in the research. And that's that cultural differences meaningfully affect the ability of culturally different international actors to arrive at shared meaning from shared texts and events. So that was confirmed, which all that lets me do is move forward into chapter five.
Yeah.
But I think it does leave these really interesting questions that I would love for other scholars to engage, like, to look through my chapter four, not, I don't care about it being my chapter four, but I'd love for people to look at the things that I was looking at and build those out. People who are better equipped to do that. Because I think some of the implications for us in terms of our practice of global Christian reasoning, our practice of missiology, our practice of, you know, global and local theology, could really be interesting, you know, through some of those lenses.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for the purposes of the setup chapter that you did, right, purpose was served. You were able to get your conclusion that moves you forward into the next chapter. The bummer, I wish we had more time this morning, is to hone in on each of these because they're so fascinating. I mean, to even just think and consider how frameworks of shame and honor or guilt and innocence are impacting this epistemic community who has a shared, say, biblical text, but coming to maybe wide ranges of interpretations of various passages and even theological ideas on the basis of these categories. So wondering like how, you know, if we're in a more guilt sort of based in environment or in a cultural setting where that's emphasized, say maybe more than shame, how that can really cause us to especially pick certain Bible passages as like, these things are the ones that really matter.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And same with things like time orientation. So the past, present, and future elements that you raise there in terms of certain forms of orientation.
Oh, eschatologically, it's fascinating.
Oh, man. It has to be.
One of the questions that's raised is, should it be actually maybe more of an eschatology of the present instead of an eschatology of the future? That's a fascinating idea.
Yeah. In Western, you know, Westerners often feel incredibly uncomfortable with passages where Jesus talks about the kingdom is in your midst. It's like, no, that's coming later. You know, right. Jesus is, that's way later. It's a second coming thing. You know, we can't make sense of it because we're so future oriented.
Yeah.
Right.
I think one of the phrases that came out, and I know you and I had encountered this in Julian's writing in the global theology for the local church, or local theology for the global church. That's it.
Yep.
But but Julian quoted actually a college prof of mine, which I had not realized until I was doing the research, Nebuchadnezzar, who talks about pre-understandings and how important our cultural pre-understandings are, and how as people are reading the scripture from these different backgrounds, the pre-understandings they're bringing with them, they're not choosing that, right? Like they're coming from these cultural perspectives, and those pre-understandings shape what they even see in the text. And I think that's fascinating. That's the key that then I think moves us into the next chapter.
It's what's so frustrating when I hear some Christian people use phrases like the plain meaning of scripture, you know, and I'm like, well, plain to who?
To
like,
who,
plain
right?
Yeah, because right. It makes sense to
with
you.
Which pre-understandings. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Plain reading usually means the reading I agree with too. It's just kind of funny, right? And certainly like the reading that makes most sense to me, yeah. It's just plain.
And I think I actually appreciate some of what's intended with that, but I think that if there's not a good amount of critical self-reflection going on, that there's definitely a chance of either intentionally or unintentionally missing something.
I'm not sure I really am as sympathetic as you are to that, because, you know, I even just think of how easy would it be for someone in a liberation context, a liberation theology context, to say, well, the plain reading is Jesus says you got to sell your stuff. Come on. Like, that's a plain reading.
That's the plain reading. That's what he says.
That the plain, nobody who emphasizes the plain plain readings from the context that I'm in would say that.
No.
That's more complicated than that.
The plain reading is that I should not do that.
yeah, exactly. And to be fair, I'm probably in that boat too, right?
That's funny.
If it were the plain reading, I believed it to be so, I probably wouldn't own anything.
Yeah.
But it raises interesting questions, doesn't it? That, like, especially about how culture and cultural presuppositions are impacting what we think is the so-called plain reading,
right.
And really how complicated that is. And what I'm not suggesting is like an idea of scripture where it's like, it's all subjectivity.
Of course. This is back to the epistemological questions we've been talking about for the last couple of years. Yeah.
Well, this is great. I really enjoyed what you did here, and hopefully maybe we'll have some time here in a future episode to maybe hone in on a few of these in more detail. And if not, then maybe our listeners, if they're interested, they can certainly contact you and hear a little bit more about what it is that you did there. And I think there's so much fruit in this chapter for people, like you said, to take it and run a little bit and see if anybody would engage it in such a way as to expand upon what's out there.
Yeah. Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. We hope you can join us for coffee again next time.
This podcast was produced by Envision Berlin in our studios located in Berlin, Germany. If you'd like to send us a note, feel free to send your email to podcast@envisionberlin.com. Thanks for listening.